Maybe you've been to one of those exhibits of artifacts from the tomb of some famous royal person. It's not that we're fascinated with death, but with the lives lived by the people entombed. And it's not just the tomb treasures we go to see. People around the world have thrilled to see the fossilized bones of people who were not exactly people, but members of species that predate current humans. Lucy, the female skeleton, may be the most famous at the moment. Lydia Pine tells the long-after-death stories of Lucy and six more in her book Seven Skeletons, The Evolution of the World's Most Famous Human Fossils. Lydia Pine is trained in history, anthropology, and the philosophy of science. She writes articles and essays for the likes of Nautilus, Public Domain Review, and The Atlantic. Her previous solo book is called simply Bookshelf, one of the series of small books called Object Lessons that we featured a few months ago. Lydia Pine, pleasure to have you on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, it's great to be here.
I understand you've had actually been around some archaeological field work. Were you ever around a human fossil dig?
Yes, I've participated in field work in South Africa, in Ethiopia, and Uzbekistan. All of those places we were looking for very old stuff there.
From that experience and from the research you did for this book, I mean, how unusual is it to find an intact skeleton, even the most of a skull, for example?
It's pretty rare. And that's one of the things that really struck me in writing a book like Seven Skeletons, is just how much this sort of rare discovery really sort of catches hold in the public mind. And it sort of, I think, champions that kind of rare discovery.
Right from the get-go, you make us realize that these long-dead people have lives, in a sense, that began when they were unearthed.
Yes, I love the idea that these fossils had these afterlives, that they're, you know, once they're discovered, I think that traditionally we sort of think about they're discovered, they're studied, they're put in a museum. And what I was really interested in doing with Seven Skeletons was finding all of the little stories and all of the connections and all of the different ways that these fossils had lived between those connection points, between the discovery, between the scientific studies and their museum lives. And these different stories could be through newspapers, they could be through fan fiction, through marketing, through press releases, through all of these sorts of things. And I was really interested in finding these different ways that these fossils lived these vibrant lives. They still do.
Fan fiction, huh? People write their own stories about the likes of what happened to Lucy or the Tong Child?
They do, actually, which completely shocked me. And people have done this actually since the 1930s. When I was working with the archives at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, looking at the Tong Child and studying the archival life of the Tong Child, I came across these novellas and these poems and these basically what we would call today fan fiction, written about the Tong Child and sent to the fossil's discoverer. It was completely unexpected.
Is it that they feel wistful for how the people died, or they just are fascinated by their lives or the circumstances?
They're fascinated by the story of the fossil. And so people take the fossil and sort of create other stories about it, or they take the fossil and they put it into epic poems and sagas, that there's a sense that the fossil resonates on a cultural level. I think it's all in good fun, but it was completely unexpected.
And in fact, there's a rather lengthy poem that you just put a chunk of in here about the Piltdown Man, isn't there?
There is, actually. I wish I had had the space to include the whole thing, but it does go on for about 9 pages, and I felt that just strained readers to walk through that. But yeah, it's amazing to find these kind of poetic gems just in the archives.
Speaking of the Piltdown Man, which turned out to be a hoax, why include the Piltdown Man in this book of Seven Skeletons?
Right, and it's one of those that I kind of went back and forth with when I was working with the book's design. But I felt that it was an incredibly important fossil to include in the history of, because of its role in the history of science, that for 40 years, that this fossil really had been a quote-unquote ancestor, a sort of missing link, and that for 40 years, that this fossil and this discovery had shaped the development of paleoanthropological theory. It had shaped the methods. It had really sort of offered this kind of direction for how science was going to be done. And I felt that including it sort of gave a nod to that kind of historical place. Although, as you point out, it is a hoax. It has been debunked. It has been it has been a hoax now for 60 years, so longer than it was ever a fossil. It has been a not fossil. But I still think it's this fantastic example of, gosh, of sort of science and culture and practice of doing that coming together.
And the mystery is still unsolved about Piltdown Man, isn't it?
It is, actually. There was a paper published a couple of weeks ago, actually, out of the Natural History Museum of London that studied everything about Piltdown, from the archives to the fossils to the bone pieces themselves. And they put forward the theory that Charles Dawson, the discoverer of the Piltdown remains, is probably the best candidate for the perpetrator of the hoax. But I think the jury is still out for the final complete say.
Lydia, could the list have been much longer than seven, or are these the best known extant skeletons that you were dealing with?
I think the list could have been much longer. And certainly if you were to talk to different paleoanthropological experts, there would be almost this sense of, well, why not this fossil or why not this fossil? But I felt that these seven exemplified scientific celebrity in distinct and unique ways, that the Piltdown is famous because it's a hoax, and the Tong Child is famous because it's sort of the story of overcoming adversity and scientific doubt, and the Hobbit was famous because it resonates with popular culture like Lord of the Rings, all of those sorts of things. So I picked these seven because I felt that they exemplified scientific celebrity in ways that that others didn't.
And the full list is The Old Man of La Chapelle, The Piltdown Man we talked about, Tong Child, Peking Man, Lucy, Flo the Hobbit, and Sidiba. And we'll talk about these all a little more in length with Lydia Pine, the author of Seven Skeletons, when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange. You can join us as well. We'll take your phone calls and emails about these famous fossils. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back with Lydia in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Lydia Pine, the author of Seven Skeletons, The Evolution of the World's Most Famous Human Fossils. We're talking about not just fossils, but famous fossils. We're talking about the Old Man of La Chapelle, Tong Child, Peking Man, Lucy, Flo, the Hobbit, and Sidiba, in addition to the Piltdown Man, the hoax. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about why these fossils got so famous and what they represent, not just scientifically, but also culturally. 800-838-3760 for your input by phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. There's a great story about the beginning of this for you, really, Lydia, the seeing that the Tong Child brought out of the box in which the remains are kept at Witwatersrand. And Professor Tobias did what with the skull?
So this is a great story. I love this story, and I was so excited to be able to include it in Seven Skeletons. So when I was an undergraduate, I had the opportunity to attend a field school for paleoanthropology and archaeology. And as part of this field school, we went to the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg to see a fossil demo, to see many of the famous fossils that have come out of South Africa, and to be able to see them for ourselves with these professional and famous scientists sort of showing them off. And at that point, Professor Tobias really was sort of the most eminent paleoanthropologist in South Africa, and it was such an honor to see him and to hear him talk about these fossils. And so all of us as undergraduates are sort of anticipating being able to see this famous fossil, this Tong Child, which is a fossil that has three parts. It has a fossilized brain case, it has a face, and it has a little mandible. When the Tong Child died, it was about 3 years old. So the fossils are very small. They're really amazing. So anyway, at the end of the fossil demo, Professor Tobias pulls the fossils out of this box and sort of puts them together in his hand so that he's holding these three parts together. And all of us are just, you know, in awe. We're just rapt with the fact that we're seeing this real fossil in real life. And then Tobias actually sort of starts to move the mandible up and down and sort of almost like he's doing this ventriloquy act. And all of us were just shocked. He has the fossil tell us a couple of jokes. He sort of, you know, has a comment on the weather, all of these sorts of things. And it felt just like it was this complete dissonance. I mean, how do you have something that's as famous as this fossil, you know, being this sort of comedic sidekick to a very eminent scientist? And all of us were just shocked.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, what is so amazing about this story, though, is that you can talk to just about any scientist who had worked with Professor Tobias, and they would tell you exactly the same story. And it was just this sort of shtick that he had, that this was part of showing off the Tang child. And I love that idea.
I wonder if, in fact, that probably helps the way that we kind of view the skeletons as part of us, part of our current culture in a way.
Oh, I think so. I think that it's a way of anthropomorphizing the fossil. I think it's a way of sort of helping us to think about them as a character, as a dynamic thing, rather than just this static pile of bones, that suddenly it becomes that much more real.
You know, the reverence is kind of funny, though, in a couple of other ways, though, like the fact that you can get T-shirts and all kinds of... What kinds of other trinkets have you seen along with some of these displayed fossils as they've traveled?
Oh, my goodness. I feel like I have this entire collection now of just, you know, the material ephemera of these fossils. So I found a T-shirt that says I Love Lucy, sort of done in that I Love Lucy script, but it has the fossil as a background. That's definitely one of my favorites. At a museum in South Africa, I found a pair of toenail clippers that actually have famous fossils put on the top of that. That was kind of unexpected. I have seen tons of postcards and keychains and just sort of any kind of marketing or merchandising that you would think of. I think I have found it with these fossils. Not all of them, of course, you know, not all of these fossils are marketed in the same way. But certainly different ones are marketed. The Sidiba, actually, you can buy a little Sidiba skull for a necklace, actually, at a couple of museums in South Africa as well.
Wow. So this is the attitude we take toward the Seven Skeletons, which is the title of Lydia Pine's book about the evolution of the world's most famous human fossils, which really took on a life of their own after they were discovered thousands, if not millions, of years after their deaths. You can join us on The Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's do a quick rundown of the list and talk about the basic significance of each of these. The Old Man of La Chapelle in France.
Sure. So the Old Man of La Chapelle is a Neanderthal skeleton. It was discovered in 1908 by a team of French prehistorians and archaeologists. The brothers Amédée and Jean Boussinet and their colleague Louis Bourdon. And when the Old Man of La Chapelle was discovered in 1908, it was the first mostly complete skeleton of a Neanderthal that had been discovered, and had been discovered in situ, which means that when the archaeologists were excavating in the cave, they came across the skeleton as they were digging down into the cave floor. And this circumstance, this situation of how the skeleton was put into the floor, led the archaeologists to conclude that the Neanderthal had been buried, that it had been purposefully buried. And this was a really interesting sort of moment in archaeology at the beginning of the 20th century, that maybe there's another species that buried their dead. And this really worked to challenge the notions of what kind of behavior makes Homo sapiens human. And so the archaeologist sent the skeleton off to the museum in Paris to be examined by an anatomist, Marison Boulet. And Boulet's interpretation of the Neanderthal was really, to be honest, not flattering. It was not a flattering interpretation. He reconstructed the Neanderthal as being very stooped, very hunched, very sort of knuckle-dragging, sort of every kind of dumb stereotype that we think of with a Neanderthal comes to us courtesy of Marison Boulet in 1911. And I think that archaeologists now have worked for decades to sort of counter this idea that Neanderthals are brutish and stupid and have no culture.
The depictions are very much more flattering and look a lot more like humans when you see them now. Yeah,
they do. And that was one of the really exciting things about looking at the museum reconstructions was to see, as you point out, how these reconstructions have changed through time.
Okay, so that's the Old Man of La Chapelle. We talked about the hoax of Piltdown Man, Tong Child, we've talked about a bit. Peking Man is from China from the 20th century. Most of this is in the 20th century, these discoveries, right?
All of these discoveries are in the 20th century, except for Sidiba, which is discovered in 2008, and the Hobbit, or Flo, Homo floresiensis, which is discovered in 2003. But definitely the 20th century is sort of where we start making fossils famous. You had asked about Peking Man, which was discovered at the site of Zhoukoudian in China over the course of two field seasons in the 1920s and 1930s. It was discovered by an international team of researchers that were looking at prehistory in China at Zhoukoudian, which is just outside of Beijing, or Peking as it was called then. So Peking Man is actually a swath of individuals. It's not just one individual, but it's several individuals that are collectively called Peking Man. It was originally, the species was originally called Sinanthropus pekingensis, and we now consider the species to be Homo erectus. And when the fossils were discovered, it was exciting that these were some of the first big discoveries that were coming out of China. And the Cenozoic Laboratory that was set up in Peking was very excited, lots of international collaboration. But with the advent of World War II, the laboratory was very concerned that if the Japanese army invaded, that the fossils would be lost or destroyed or something would happen to them. So researchers boxed up the fossils and sent them out of Peking under military escort. The U.S. team, the U.S. sent a team of Marines actually to escort the fossils out of Peking, and the fossils were never heard from again, actually. And so it's this great unsolved mystery in paleoanthropology of what happened to these fossils. And there are lots of accounts and lots of different possibilities and lots of effort that's put into trying to trace these fossils, but they have not been recovered.
Lucy may be the fossil that everybody has heard about, and this is a very, very complete skeleton. I mean, not all of it there, but a whole lot of it. And it's significant. Why?
So Lucy is, as you point out, I think the most famous of all famous fossils. She definitely is sort of the icon and the pinnacle of becoming a celebrity scientific discovery. So Lucy was discovered in November of 1974 by paleoanthropologist Donald Johansson, who was working in northern Ethiopia in the Afar region, which is actually where her scientific name comes from. Her species name is Afarensis, and that refers to the Afar part of her geographic location where she was discovered. And this was an incredibly exciting find in the mid-1970s because it showed this really exciting evidence for bipedalism, where it gave researchers an opportunity to examine what it meant for a hominin to be bipedal 3 million years ago, which is how old Lucy is. And so it really spoke to, not only was the fossil complete and exciting and interesting, but it really spoke to very pertinent scientific questions that were at the forefront of paleoanthropology in the 1970s.
And then Flo, who's been referred to as the Hobbit, this discovery was in 2003 when the Lord of the Rings series was just getting started. There was significance not just because of Lord of the Rings and the name it was easily given to her, but this was unusual in size, wasn't it? The discovery of Flo?
Right, exactly. So Flo stands roughly 3 feet 6 inches tall. She's an adult. The species Homo floresiensis made and used stone tools, made and used fire. The species has been dated to somewhere between 60 and 100,000 years ago. When the first research was coming out about Homo floresiensis, the date was even sooner. The species had been dated to about 18,000 years ago. But as you point out, that it's this sort of the moment that it's described and published in 2004, it's right as this craze, right as people are ready to start thinking about hobbits. And so even though it's scientifically interesting and fascinating and gives us this great insight into the sort of complexities of speciation during the Pleistocene. It's also, it looks just like a hobbit. And so it really sort of was able to catch, I think, the public's imagination and scientific imagination as well. And to use that, that sort of already, we're already thinking about small creatures, and to use that to really propel itself to be a celebrity scientific discovery.
Sidiba is also the most recent discovery, 2008 in South Africa. A lot of argument about this one. It seems like a lot of controversy.
It is, actually. And I think that if you were to look at all of the other species sort of in the first decade of their discovery, I think that we would find just as much controversy and just as much question that's still out there. And so I think that if we were to look at Sidiba in 50 years, I think it would look very different than how it does today. But you're right. It has been incredibly controversial. It was discovered, as you say, in 2008, published in 2010. And in the last 5 years, since its publication, it has been on the cover of Science magazine, which is incredibly prestigious. And it's a feat that's been completely unprecedented to be on the cover of Science that many times, for one scientific discovery to be on the cover of Science that many times. It's something that hasn't been repeated in any kind of scientific discipline. And so when you walk into the Institute's hall to study Sidiba or to study the fossils there at the Witwatersrand University, you see these giant sort of headshots of these covers for Science magazine, and it feels almost like you're walking into a modeling agency or something to see the sort of resonance that these covers have.
It's I just read that in the New Yorker piece about Lee Berger, who was the main researcher here. It seems like he's a bit of a lightning rod himself because he's so much into the TV part of things.
I think that that's one of the things that comes up between, especially with Sidiba and Lucy and some of the older fossils, is a lot of the fossils' celebrity and the ability to sort of resonate with public audiences is due in large part to somebody, to a scientist being their cheerleader and to really work to integrate the fossil into either mainstream pop culture or mainstream sort of popular science. And I think that Berger certainly is doing that with Sidiba.
So I'm reminded by the dates here that it seems like hominin fossil collection was largely a 20th century thing. Was there no digging before then, or were people just going, bones, and chucking them away?
Right. So paleoanthropology is actually a relatively young science. It is a 20th century phenomenon that it becomes sort of its own science at the beginning of the 20th century. The first fossil species, though, to be described is Neanderthals, which happens in 1856. And so in 1856, discoveries from the Neander Valley in Germany, which is where Neanderthals get their name, were anatomically described. They were described as a species, and that's the first sort of not human fossil species that we see. But it's not until the 20th century that other fossil species are described and that we really begin to get a handle or begin to explore the kind of complexity that we see in the fossil record today.
When you're writing about the discovery of Flo, the so-called hobbit, I mean, you're writing about the fact that a trowel actually struck the skull. I mean, so I'm just wondering if anybody has reached some conclusions about how many things might have been lost over the years, either by indifference or by just getting broken by machinery or just humans digging?
Yeah, it's actually that's a really great question. And it's a really sort of complex thing that happens. And there are so many different factors at play, whether a site is an archaeological site where things are being excavated in sort of grids, whether a site is being surveyed and fossils are being collected from the surface on survey, like Lucy. It really depends a lot on the context of the site, sort of how fossils will be recovered, what the modes for error are, those sorts of things. And so, as you point out, it definitely depends on the kind of fossil that's there.
So ultimately, Lydia, I mean, is there a possibility that there could be fossils just as deserving of celebrity as these seven skeletons sitting in a drawer or a vault someplace?
It's hard. I think it's a hard question. even though it feels like it should be such a straightforward question. I think that there are definitely fossils that have the same scientific value and the same scientific import that these seven celebrity fossils do. But I think that in order for the discovery to really reach that kind of fame and that kind of celebrity, I think that it needs to sort of happen in a particular historical moment, that not only does the science have to really resonate with the scientific community, but it also has to resonate with popular culture, with museums, with other ways for people to engage with these skeletons or with these fossils. And so I think that it's hard to find other fossils that do that, that reach all of those audiences the way that these seven do. But certainly in the future, I think that we could have new famous ones.
Okay, not entirely unlikely given what's happened with these seven. Certainly they've been through a lot over their long time on the Earth. Seven Skeletons, The Evolution of the World's Most Famous Human Fossils is the book by Lydia Pine, who's been our guest on The Exchange. Lydia, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right, good to have you.